have a lot of Americans that need homes. We should be kicking out illegal immigrants who are competing for those homes, and we should be building more homes for the American citizens who deserve to be here.
Housing costs are on the minds of many Americans. How might the market change in a second Trump presidency?
It's Friday, November 8th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Before the election, Donald Trump and his allies repeated false claims that non-citizens were going to vote illegally.
Some worry the claims may have caused eligible immigrant voters to stay home.
There were reports of folks being asked about their citizenship based specifically on how they looked. And that is the type of thing that is probably a result of the rhetoric leading up to this election.
And in Florida, the fishing industry is struggling to recover after the state was battered by major hurricanes.
We've never seen anything like Helene. That amount of wind, that amount of flood just hurt so many people up and down this coast.
That's ahead. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Special Counsel Jack Smith is asking a federal judge for a few more weeks to figure out how to unwind the D.C. prosecution of President-elect Donald Trump. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports the Justice Department calls the situation unprecedented.
Donald Trump is a criminal defendant who's pleaded not guilty to four felony charges in connection with his effort to cling to power in 2020. But he's also now the president-elect, awaiting a return to the White House in January. A longstanding Justice Department policy says sitting presidents cannot be indicted or tried. So lawyers working for Special Counsel Jack Smith are asking a judge in Washington, D.C. to wipe away deadlines in the case against him. They say they'll have more to share with Judge Tanya Chutkan by early December. The prosecutors are considering ways to step away from a separate case against Trump in Florida over his hoarding of classified documents and alleged obstruction of justice. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Speaking publicly for the first time since losing the election to Republicans Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said he knows some Americans are worried. Walz saying, "I'm one of them." Walz says the agenda is very different from what he and Kamala Harris were proposing, but he also said he'll be making sure people in his state have their rights protected.
Look, we know what's coming down the pike. We know it because they told us. And we're going to have to be ready to defend the progress that we've made here in Minnesota. The other side spent a lot of time campaigning and talking about and promising that they would leave things up to the states. Well, I'm willing to take them at their word for that.
Speaking to an audience at a local high school, Walz also addressed the 1.5 million Minnesotans who voted for Trump, saying, quote, "There should be a place in our politics for everyone to be heard." Notre Dame's bells rang out over Paris for the first time since the April 2019 fire that heavily damaged the iconic cathedral. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports this is a symbolic step before the cathedral reopens December 7th.
Among the eight bells that rang out from Notre Dame's belfry Friday morning, three are brand new. The others were restored after the fire. The bells weigh between just under 1 and 4 tons. Their arrival back in the cathedral marks a milestone in the painstaking restoration and modernization of the 861-year-old church. Some of Notre Dame's restoration work will continue beyond the opening date, notably on its stained glass windows and on the total refurbishment of the cathedral grounds. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
More Americans were standing in unemployment lines last week, though the number of people being laid off from their jobs remains at historically low levels. Labor Department reporting today first-time jobless claims rose modestly. Stocks closed sharply higher today, the Dow up 259 points. This is NPR. Dutch authorities say Israeli fans were assaulted after a soccer game in Amsterdam by groups of young people apparently encouraged via social media to attack Jewish people. Five people had to be treated at hospitals following the assaults and dozens were arrested. Reports of anti-Semitism, vandalism and violence have been on the rise since the start of the war in Gaza. Nominations for the 2025 Grammy Awards are out. The Recording Academy unveiled the major categories this morning, with Beyoncé, Taylor Swift, and Kendrick Lamar leading in nominations. NPR's Sydney Madden has more. This ain't Texas.
Cowboy Carter, Beyoncé's eighth studio album, secured the most nominations this year, appearing in 11 categories. In addition to being up for Album of the Year and Song of the Year, the superstar is also nominated in a surprising array of genres, including pop, Americana, country, and melodic rap categories. Including these 11 nods, Beyoncé is now the most nominated artist in Grammy's history, with 99 total nominations. can for afford. Grammy's darling Taylor Swift and breakout pop stars Chapel Roan and Sabrina Carpenter each pulled in 6 nominations. The 67th Annual Grammy Awards will take place on Sunday, February 2nd, 2025, in Los Angeles. Sydney Madden, NPR News.
Dozens of rhesus monkeys bred for research remain at large in South Carolina, but they apparently have not strayed too far. The 43 monkeys escaped after an employee failed to fully lock a door. They've been spotted in woods nearby the Alpha Genesis facility. Workers have been using food to try to recapture them. Federal officials and police say they do not pose a threat. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It is 5:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. We receive support from Fire in the Village, a collective of artists and cultural organizers using art, music, and fashion to build community. Presenting a collection of live concert events featuring David Huckfeldt and Annie Humphrey in Grand Rapids, Bemidji, Brainerd, and Aitkin this November. Showtimes and locations are available at fireinthevillage.org. Now back to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In the last few days, we've heard a lot that this was a pocketbook election, that the top issue for voters was the cost of living and their economic prospects. And top of mind there for many people is this question: am I ever going to be able to afford a house? Well, President-elect Trump is now headed back to the White House, so how might the housing market change? Let's hear from NPR housing correspondent Laurel Wamsley. Hey there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Laurel, we know that the cost of housing was a huge campaign issue, but how did it get to be this expensive?
Well, the housing market really changed during the pandemic. As you might remember, there was this big spike in demand as people wanted more space, and mortgage rates at the time were super low, and then prices spiked with that demand. And now prices are still high. There was hope that mortgage rates would be dropping by now, but that happened only briefly before they just started rising again. The Fed cut interest rates by a quarter point this week, but it's not really making an impact on mortgage rates. And housing supply overall just hasn't kept up with the demand. So all of this really affects how people feel about their financial future. Buying a home has, like, always been this cornerstone of the American dream, and now that's becoming out of reach for a lot of people.
Okay, looking ahead to the new administration, what has Trump said that he will do to address these housing costs?
Right. Well, he's talked about a few different things. One is bringing down mortgage rates, and another is deregulation to make it cheaper to build homes. So on the mortgage rate issue, Trump says he will slash inflation and mortgage rates will drop. But it's not as easy as he makes it sound, and many experts say that Trump's economic plans will actually be inflationary. And I want to note that mortgage rates aren't set by the Fed and they aren't set by the president. They tend to follow a number of factors, including what's happening in bond markets. And right now, despite the Fed's cuts, mortgage rates are still pretty high. And then when it comes to deregulation, the reality is that much of that red tape that does make it hard and expensive to build housing are at the state and local level, not federal.
Right. So, Laurel, are there other federal actions the Trump administration could take here other than deregulation?
Well, another idea that Trump has pushed is opening up some federal lands for housing. For this, think about wide open spaces out west, but not national parks. But a lot of this federal land isn't super close to metro areas that really do need the housing, so this might not move the needle too much.
Another key Trump campaign issue was immigration, and Trump blamed undocumented immigrants for driving up housing costs. What do economists make of that claim?
Well, there is some effect from immigration on housing prices, just as there is with any population growth. But experts say that the Trump campaign overstated the impact. Here's his running mate, J.D. Vance, during the vice presidential debate.
We have a lot of Americans that need homes. We should be kicking out illegal immigrants who are competing for those homes, and we should be building more homes for the American citizens who deserve to be here.
If Trump does move forward with his plan for mass deportation, it'll have a number of effects on the housing market, depending on exactly what he ends up doing.
Give me some examples.
Well, carrying this all out would likely cost the federal government a lot of money, and that spending could lead to higher mortgage rates. And construction costs would probably go up, since some of those who might be deported are people who work in home building. On the other hand, if millions of people really are forced to leave the country, that would obviously open up some homes, though it's not really clear how many, since some migrant families do double and triple up in the housing that they can find.
All right, Laurel, what are you watching for next?
Well, there's data out this week from the National Association of Realtors that suggests that the worst might be over. Home prices are rising more slowly now, and rising wages are outpacing them. And more inventory and new homes are coming onto the market. But housing affordability is still pretty bad. But the big picture here is that the president can certainly make an impact on affordability. But the housing market is really complex, and the problems that we're facing right now were long in the making, and they're going to be long in the solving.
NPR's Laurel Wamsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, voting is over, and the political landscape has shifted. So what have we learned? Well, NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro has been digging into how President-elect Trump won a second time, and at the end of this massively eventful week, he is here with some takeaways. Hey, Domenico.
Hey, great to be with you.
We know that Trump won over historic margins with a number of voting groups. Can you dig into why that happened?
Well, most importantly, I mean, the landscape of the issues in this election really favored Republicans for years. I mean, President Biden's approval dropped with the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. His approval rating really hasn't recovered since. Despite improvements in inflation, Americans haven't viewed the economy positively. The housing market, as we were just hearing about, is still inaccessible for many. Car payments, groceries remain relatively expensive because the very fixed inflation, the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, which with the improvements, they've started cutting them. And many people were upset about high border crossings. And look, the bottom line is people were in a bad mood and blamed President Biden. And it's really tough when you're the number two, as Vice President Harris is, to separate yourself from the administration's policies.
So are you saying Harris was really dragged down by Biden? She just wasn't able to break from him?
I mean, look, to Harris's credit, I have to say, looking at the exit polls, she was performing better than Biden on who people trust more on the economy. But when three quarters of people say inflation caused them a degree of hardship, two thirds have a negative view of the economy, and only a quarter of people think that they're better off now than they were 4 years ago economically, that's tough to overcome when you're the party in power.
Okay, shifting to governing in Washington, we know a president's accomplishments are closely tied to control of Congress. Republicans now control the Senate. We don't yet know which party will control the House. Where does that stand?
It's very close. There's a lot left to count on the West Coast. It's still possible Democrats win the House, but right now, Republicans have the edge to keep it, you know, with anywhere from a one to maybe four seat majority even. And that would be an even tighter margin, potentially, if it's less than four, than Republicans have right now. They've struggled to keep their coalition together trying to pass legislation. So either party is going to face differing degrees of challenges in trying to govern.
There was some speculation coming in that Democrats could do it. Why does it look like that's not going to happen?
Well, while there was some ticket splitting, I mean, we saw several Democrats, for example, do better in Senate races, pick up or hold on to some House seats that maybe they weren't expected to. But it's really hard to swim against that tide at the top of the ticket. You know, there were three competitive House races, for example, in Pennsylvania, where Democrats very narrowly lost and might have won if Harris had won the state. So, you know, what we're looking at now is a very narrow House majority, regardless of who wins control. And whoever's in charge won't have a lot of margin for error here.
Unsurprisingly, Democrats are finger-pointing and soul-searching. What's your take on where they go from here?
This happens after every election, and I will say that it's a good motto for all things in life, but beware of people offering simple solutions for complex problems. You know, nobody knows exactly what will happen or how or if Democrats dig out of this. You know, they had won these previously solidly Democratic groups who were more working class, and those voters did flip to Republicans, and that's a trend that we've seen for a while, and it was more pronounced in this election. The Democratic Party is certainly in danger of becoming a party just for elites, and that's difficult to win elections if that's the case.
So can they dig out from that?
I mean, no one really knows. For all the finger-pointing that's going on and is going to take place, what would the result have been, I wonder, you know, if a Republican was in the White House when perceptions of the economy were this bad? And there have been lots of these reflections in the past 20 years when people thought that what they knew, happened and then turned out to be incredibly wrong. I mean, think about 2004. Books were written about a potential permanent red majority because white evangelicals were a new force for the Republican Party. In 2008, there was talk of a permanent liberal majority with Obama's win. Others were saying that we were in a post-racial America. After 2012, Republicans were advocating for comprehensive immigration reform because they thought they'd never be able to win over Latinos if they didn't. Well, they went in a very decisively different direction with Donald Trump, and he has apparently won a record share of them for a Republican ever. So we just don't know. We shouldn't profess to know how things will change. In politics, usually it's that the right candidate at the right time with the right environment wins, even when it's hard to see that path now.
NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
baby animals being born from cloned endangered species. It kind of sounds like something out of Jurassic Park.
Well, in this case, the story is real. For the first time in U.S. history, a cloned endangered species has produced offspring.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently announced that Antonia, a cloned black-footed ferret, had given birth to three kits after mating with a male named Urchin. One baby died shortly after birth, but the other two, a girl and a boy named Seabird and Red Cloud, are healthy.
This is a huge first. These kits that were born this year are born to one of only three cloned ferrets in the world.
That's Tina Jackson. She's the Blackfooted Ferret Recovery Coordinator with Fish and Wildlife. She says the world needs more blackfooted ferrets.
Though they were once common in North America, there are now only about 370 out in the wild, according to the World Wildlife Fund. Habitat loss and disease have hurt the population.
We have a number of partners where we do reintroductions, working with different landowners and trying to get the ferrets that are produced in the captive program out into the wild, back out where they belong. At this point in time, still struggling with a few threats out there across the landscape, but this offers some additional hope.
Black-footed ferrets were thought to be extinct until 1981 when they were rediscovered in Wyoming. That discovery launched a conservation effort that ultimately led to Antonia and her kits.
Though Antonia's not even 2 years old yet, her DNA comes from a ferret named Willa, who died in 1988. Willa's DNA is special, new to the current population of black-footed ferrets, the rest of whom are all descended from just seven other ferrets.
So Willa's genes coming into the program overall represents a potential increase in the genetics of the captive population of ferrets.
And now with the arrival of Red Cloud and Seabird and the genetic diversity they represent, there's new hope for future generations of black-footed ferrets.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. We receive support from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, offering a complimentary first music lesson for all new students. This lesson, combined with financial assistance for all ages, including adults, ensures that music education is accessible to everyone. More at headwatersmusicandarts.org. Bemidji High School presents Mean Girls tonight and tomorrow at 7 p.m. each night, recommended for ages 13 and up. Bemidji Contra Dance hosts a community dance tomorrow at 6:30 at Rail River Folk School. All dances will be taught by the caller, with live music from 4 Mile Portage. Bemidji Parks and Recreation is putting on a community puzzle swap at the historic Carnegie Library tomorrow. You can drop off up to 10 gently used and complete puzzles and then receive a voucher. They'll be open Saturday from 9 a.m. until noon. Minnesota's firearm deer season opens tomorrow. The DNR reminds hunters that they are required to register every deer within 48 hours of harvest. Certain permit areas also require chronic wasting disease testing. Go to DNR's website, and don't forget to wear Blaze Orange whenever you're in the woods during hunting season, whether you're hunting or not. The AARP Tax Aid Program is seeking volunteers to help seniors and people with modest incomes to prepare their income taxes in the new year. Volunteers are especially needed in the Grand Rapids and Bemidji areas. Training is provided, and all new volunteers will have a mentor to help guide them. For more information, visit aarpfoundation.org/taxaid. That's aid with an E at the end. Now back to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In the lead-up to the election, President-elect Trump and his allies repeatedly claimed that non-citizens were poised to somehow vote illegally in large numbers. There's no sign that happened. And once Trump was declared the winner, those claims melted away. As NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports, the false claims are likely to have an impact for years to come.
Trump and his allies have long been repeating a message about Democrats and migrants. Here's Trump in January.
They're signing them up to vote. And I believe that's why you're having millions of people pour into our country. And it could very well affect the next election. And I believe that's why they're doing it.
That baseless idea spawned a flurry of pre-election lawsuits that were seen as placeholders in case Trump lost and wanted to challenge the results. Elon Musk, the owner of the social media platform X, amplified similar claims. And right-wing influencers shared videos on X they suggested showed evidence of a supposed plot to get non-citizens to vote.
James O'Keefe here in North Philadelphia.
Content creator James O'Keefe posted this video just one day before the election.
They are telling people that all you need is what's called a TIN number, that's I-TIN number, and you can vote if you're not a citizen of the United States.
But by the next evening, mentions of non-citizens and voting had basically dried up online.
Simply put, it did not come up in a substantial or organized conversation on Election Day.
Danielle Lee Thompson is the research manager for the University of Washington Center for an Informed Public and has been tracking false election narratives.
I think the folks who drew attention to those kinds of narratives to begin with have other focuses now that Trump has won.
The claim was used to help drive voters to the polls. Eight states had ballot measures reaffirming that it's illegal for non-citizens to vote. All the initiatives passed, including in North Carolina, where volunteers have been scouring voter rolls for potential ineligible voters and non-citizens. The effort is led by Jim Womack, who's also the Republican Party chair for Lee County.
You know, it's still very early after the election. I don't think non-citizens had a dramatic impact on the election.
There's just one pending case so far. A Chinese college student in Michigan has been criminally charged for allegedly casting an early ballot, even though he's not a U.S. citizen. This year, Womack's group made Spanish language signs, warning that non-citizen voting is a crime that's punishable with deportation.
We put them up at the polling sites around the state to help prevent non-citizens from committing a crime.
Womack called it a service for non-citizens who may have been registered accidentally. But Ileana Santillan of the Latino advocacy organization El Pueblo says the signs have confused some immigrants who just became citizens.
So we've had a few people ask about whether or not they can vote because they're naturalized citizens.
She and other advocates worry the signs may have dissuaded some eligible immigrant voters. Voting rights attorney Danielle Lang spent Election Day answering voters' calls for a National Election Protection Hotline.
There were reports of folks being kind of asked about their citizenship, basically on how they looked. And that is the type of thing that is the natural result of the rhetoric leading up to this election.
And that rhetoric is likely to continue. Some who promoted the non-citizen voting narrative this year have vowed to push for new voter registration policies that will require proof of citizenship. Though voting rights advocates worry that will result in more barriers for eligible voters. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
Anyone who has tried to visit Israel since the Gaza war began knows that air travel has gotten complicated. International flights face long delays or are suddenly canceled, depending on the security situation. This has been a windfall for Israel's airlines, particularly national carrier El Al. NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports from Tel Aviv.
It's just past 3 o'clock in the morning, and a long line of passengers snakes through a security check-in here at Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. The rest of the departures hall is quiet. The departures and arrival board explains why. It shows dozens of scheduled flights by international carriers canceled or delayed. In contrast, all flights on LL Airlines are operating.
since the beginning of the conflict. We find ourselves being, most of the time, the only carrier flying. We are one of the very, very few ways of going in and out of Israel.
Omri Cohen is chief operating officer at LL Airlines. He says when rockets and missiles start flying over Israel, many international airlines become skittish and cancel flights.
We're seeing that our competitors have been so far hesitant to return. Some have tried, and others have declared already that they won't be back for a while. And that's, that leaves us with 100% of the market, especially on the direct routes.
Not surprisingly, the bad security situation has been good news for Israel's airlines. LL's profits have surged. In August, it reported a quarterly profit of nearly 150%. That after years of running huge deficits. Cohen says during COVID, 98% of the company was furloughed and planes were grounded. Now the company is looking to buy more aircraft. But Richard Aboulafia, managing director at Aerodynamic Advisory, an aviation consultancy firm, says running an airline in emergency mode has its downsides.
You've got higher insurance premiums, and you've got the fact that you're just as vulnerable to an airport shutdown as everybody else in the event of hostilities breaking out or even just random missile fire.
And many countries don't allow Israeli airlines to fly over their airspace. Aboulafia says there are also cultural challenges, such as ultra-Orthodox men refusing to sit next to female passengers who are not part of their family, and religious holidays.
There's the endless politicized battles about whether or not they can or should fly on the Sabbath and whatever else.
For many, LL is seen as part of Israel's identity. It's been around as long as the state, 76 years. Oleg Mihailichenko, who was waiting to board his flight to Cyprus, says there's a sense of safety with LL. He says there are undercover security officials on board, and the pilots are used to maneuvering in a hostile environment.
All the pilots in LL, they are fighter pilots. They fly with F-16, F-15, and they have a lot of experience. Well, passenger carrier plane is a bit different from the fighter jets. You can't roll in the air.
Mihailichenko just wishes LL could improve the food.
My wife flew with them a few months ago in August. And she told me that the food was really, really cheap and really awful, yeah.
Cohen says the airline has been working hard to improve service on the carrier so customers continue to use LL once the war is over. One of the biggest complaints is ticket prices and that the airline is taking advantage of its near monopoly. A complaints commission is now investigating. Cohen says the high prices are a combination of last-minute purchases and a lack of availability.
What you'll find is that the economy will be fully booked, and when you go online, you'll see that the pricing that's in front of you is mainly premium and business, which is, even in regular times, higher priced.
Cohen says LL has capped some prices. Small comfort for passengers trying to get in or out of Israel. Major carriers such as American Airlines, Delta, and British Airways say they're suspending flights until at least springtime next year. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew Dzingel. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, offering opportunities in the tap room all season long for holiday shopping and gathering. Find out more about pop-up shops, rentals, events, and more on Facebook. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Now it's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. In advance of the upcoming Veterans Day holiday on November 11th, Attorney General Keith Ellison is warning Minnesota's veterans about claim shark companies. These companies prey on veterans and family members who are seeking Veterans Affairs benefits. A claim shark is an individual or company that illegally charges fees to assist or consult veterans with filing their VA benefit claims. Claim sharks are not VA accredited as required by federal law.
They target veterans or family members of veterans with aggressive and deceptive advertising. They then convince the veteran or family member to sign contracts with deceptive or unfair terms that require payment of large fees or even a percentage of benefit increases from claims. This sometimes includes claims that were filed with the VA before the contract with the claim shark was even signed. Veterans should only share sensitive information with VA-accredited attorneys, claims agents, and Veterans Service Organization representatives. Ellison asks that Minnesota veterans report scams to his office immediately. Burl Ives, who died in September, easily won the Itasca County Commissioner District 4 race on Tuesday. The county board will have to declare Ives' seat vacant again, having already done so once after his death. The county will have a special election to fill the seat sometime early next year. If more than two candidates file, a primary also will occur. Three candidates ran as write-ins in the most recent election. Gordon Stram dropped out soon after declaring his candidacy, saying there was not enough time to run a campaign. Dick Sackett continued his, but less than 4% of votes came in for write-ins. Though election season ended earlier this week, you're likely still seeing a lot of red and blue. In post-election analysis, it can be easy to get swept up in maps that color regions one solid color. But Megan Buffington says simple two-color maps erase a more purple reality.
With a Republican win in District 7B, a state house map shows northern Minnesota solid red outside of Moorhead and Duluth. The East Range District covers everything from Chisholm to Aurora, reaching north to just south of Cook, and south to Grab Meadowlands and Auburn. Since 2018, 7B's been represented by DFLer Dave Lisligard. But his surprise retirement earlier this year meant the district that has been trending right finally flipped. 7B is a great example of the problem with two-color maps. Yes, Republican Cal Warwas won the election, but over 10,000 people, 44% of voters, cast their ballots for the DFL candidate Lori Janitopoulos. Examining precinct-level results also highlights some of the stark political divides our region lives with. Red B is the most liberal precinct in northern Minnesota, where 98% of voters supported DFLer Reed Olson. Just 20 miles to the east and a district over, Shooks Township is one of the most conservative. Just 6 of 114 voters cast their ballots for DFL candidate Michael Reyes. If you include smaller precincts, every voter in O'Brien Township cast their ballot for Reyes' opponent, Matt Bliss. O'Brien Township directly borders the Red B precinct. The precinct-level results illustrate something many northern Minnesotans already know. Political preference has to be overlooked to get things done. Take Chisholm, for example. Exactly the same number of residents voted for Janitopoulos and Warwas.
This is a small community made up with a lot of different individuals, and you really need to put all that, you know, state and federal level stuff aside to get things done at the city level and, you know, focus on what's important and what benefits those inside your community.
That's Chisholm Mayor Adam Lance. He says both candidates spent a lot of time campaigning in the city, but it was always positive, with neither attacking the other side. Lance says Warwas has big shoes to fill because of how well Lisligard did advocating for their communities. He says Chisholm alone got somewhere north of $12 million for local projects.
I just know that the representation up here definitely needs to work with the representation from down south and to work together to bring money back up here.
Lance said obviously the city council has disagreements now and then, but at the end of the day, they're all focused on the betterment of the community as a whole.
That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from National Geographic documentary films, presenting Endurance. Endurance follows a team of modern-day explorers who face the Herculean task of finding Sir Ernest Shackleton's famous sunken ship, now streaming on Hulu and Disney+. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Three major hurricanes have hammered Florida's Gulf Coast in the last 2 years, and few businesses were hit harder than commercial fishermen. Boats sank, docks were destroyed, and fish storage washed away in record storm surges all along the coast. As they struggle to rebuild and recover what they lost, NPR's Greg Allen reports commercial fishermen are finding they are largely on their own.
Hurricane Idalia made landfall near Steinhatchee in August of last year. Charlie Norwood owns a marina in the small fishing town, the Sea Hag. At the time, he says it was the worst storm they'd ever seen. But this year, Hurricane Helene was worse.
We've never seen anything like Helene. That amount of wind, that amount of flood just hurt so many people up and down this coast.
13 feet above the entrance, there's a sign now marking the storm surge at the marina, the highest ever recorded there. More than a month after the storm, there's still lots of work to repair the retail store, restaurant, and motel rooms. But Norwood says in the marina, the debris has been cleared away and the docks repaired.
The idea is to get the docks back open so our fellow retail fishermen and our fellow commercial fishermen can have a point to get on and off the water. Access to the water is so critical.
After Hurricane Idalia last year, a lot changed for Norwood and others in the seafood business. Insurance costs skyrocketed, and companies limited what they would cover. At the Sea Hag, Norwood says his docks, outside deck, overhanging roof, and other structures were no longer included.
It's been horribly financially a burden.
So this is just all out of pocket then for you?
75% of it is. Yeah. Just like the commercial guys, my comrades on the water, they got the same problems. You know, it's out of pocket. They didn't create the storm. But it is what it is. There's no insurance they can buy for the most part.
Fisherman Eddie Trotter says he made it through this year's hurricanes okay, but many of the businesses he sold fish to were knocked out in the storms.
Almost a month we didn't get to go to work at all. So
what does that do to your income?
Oh, killed us. Pretty much killed us, yep.
And there's no help for that, right? That's just on you?
Not that we have seen. No, there's no help nowhere.
There was also extensive damage in Cedar Key, a community where many fishermen have moved into clam farming. Mike Allen, the director of a University of Florida biological station there, says last year Hurricane Idalia destroyed 80% of the clam stocks. This year, the damage from Hurricane Helene was worse.
In total, when you consider those two storms, this is going to be a 2.5 to 3 year setback of the shellfish industry.
In Hernando Beach, another small fishing community, Catherine Buren says the storm surge did hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage to the seafood business and marina she owns with her husband.
Our seafood business had about 5 to 6 foot of water, our marina about 4 foot. The restaurant that we rent to next door everything's got to be redone in the building.
Fishermen are a self-reliant bunch, Buren says, and used to dealing with challenges, including the hazards encountered after a hurricane.
One of them unfortunately ran into a piling that was submerged, so the boat was sinking. Made it back, we were able to pull it out and get those repairs done, and he's back to work.
For Buren and others in Florida's commercial fishing industry, they're getting back in the water at a good time, the beginning of the lucrative stone crab season. In the quickly refurbished sorting room, workers are grading stone crab claws. Buren is hoping a good season can offset some of the losses from the storms. Insurance won't cover most of her damage. To help, Florida has set aside $1 million to assist commercial seafood producers. With docks, marinas, and fish houses wrecked all along the Gulf Coast, the money won't go far. Still, after 2 years of devastating storms, she doesn't know any fishermen leaving the industry.
You know, once it dries out, it's like, okay, we've got damage. What are we going to do about it? Let's get this done. Let's get things back going again. And I think that's the way most people are seeing it.
There's something you often hear in Hernando Beach, Steinhatchee, and other towns along the Gulf Coast. Fishing isn't just a job, they say. It's a way of life. Greg Allen, NPR News, Hernando Beach, Florida.
Grammy Awards nominations came out today, and if you go by sheer numbers, it's Beyoncé's year.
This ain't Texas. Ooh.
She leads the pack with 11 nominations, which now makes her the most nominated artist in Grammy history. A lot of other artists also had multiple nods this year. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento breaks down the list.
Queen Bee has now received 99 Grammy nominations over the course of her career. Her latest, Cowboy Carter, has been talked about as her country album, but she insisted it was a Beyoncé album, and the Recording Academy took her word for it.
Genres are a funny little concept, aren't they?
Her 11 nominations this year are spread across a multitude of genres, including pop.
So sweet. I give you kisses in the backseat.
Country.
16 carriages driving away while I watch them ride.
Americana. And melodic rap. Cowboy Carter and its singles were recognized in the Song of the Year, Record of the Year, and Album of the Year categories, too. The latter is one Beyoncé has infamously never won before. Behind Beyoncé, there are several artists with 7 nominations each. Kendrick Lamar's hit, Not Like Us, was part of his rap battle with Drake this summer.
They not like us. They not like us. They not like us.
Speaking of summer, there's everyone's favorite Brit. I mean, brat. More than a decade into her career, Charlie XCX has now landed her first nominations as a solo artist. Billie Eilish, on the other hand, has won both Song of the Year and Record of the Year twice in the last 5 years, and she's up for both again this year. She'll compete in both categories with Taylor Swift and Post Malone's collaboration, Fortnite. Tied with Swift for 6 nominations are 2 of the biggest breakout stars of the year. Sabrina Carpenter. And your favorite artist's favorite artist, Chapel Roan. Notably, Roan and Carpenter are nominated in all 4 main categories: Song of the Year, Record of the Year, Album of the Year, and Best New Artist. Another Best New Artist contender is rapper-singer Shaboozey. His hit, a bar song, Tipsy, has spent more time at the top of the Billboard Hot 100 chart this year than any other song. 16 weeks and counting. And it wouldn't be the Grammys without some surprises. The Beatles received a Best Song nod for Now and Then. That song used AI to restore older recordings made by late band members John Lennon and George Harrison. Another surprise, Andre 3000 is nominated for Album of the Year. He's actually won that award before as half of the duo Outkast. They took home the trophy for their album Speaker Box, The Love Below in 2004, which also happens to be the last time a hip-hop record won Album of the Year. This time, Andre's nominated for his solo debut, an album of instrumental flute music called New Blue Sun. We'll find out if any of them can top Beyoncé at the Grammy ceremony on February 2nd, 2025. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In Sunbelt states like North Carolina, developers of low-income apartments are abandoning coastal areas. There, climate change has pushed sea levels up nearly a foot over the past 7 decades. From member station WHQR in Wilmington, Kelly Kanoyer reports.
Developer Stephanie Norris was born and raised in coastal North Carolina, and she always knew that's where she wanted to build.
I only work in North Carolina. My dad always wanted me to go do some projects in South Carolina or Virginia. No, thank you. I'm very comfortable here. And this is, my community.
Norris owns and operates 25 properties throughout the state, concentrated near the coast. They're all low-income housing tax credit properties. It's a federal program that helps developers build housing for working class and low-income people.
It's for your seniors, obviously. It's for working families.
it's kind of a broad spectrum of our entire community.
Norris's once profitable industry is starting to shift as more extreme weather events like heavy rain and hurricanes drive up insurance rates for multifamily housing.
Our affordable property locations in New Hanover County, I think it would be more on the order of about a 70% increase to the existing premiums.
That's an average premium increase of 70% each year over the past 3 years for one of her properties. Norris says that comes out to about $1,000 this year for each unit. And under federal regulations, she can't increase rent by more than $50 to cover the change. Some of her newest properties are costing her so much in insurance, she worries she won't be able to cover debt service. And then,
I'm no longer a developer anymore. I can't keep doing this, even though I love it and it's my purpose.
Rising insurance rates on low-income apartments aren't just a problem in hurricane-prone areas like the Southeast. Wildfire and winter storms have disrupted insurance markets from California to Texas. Chip Stewart is with the national insurance brokerage Hub International. He says insurance volatility is having a chilling effect on new affordable housing.
I kind of see a pause on developments. I've talked to a large developer out in California here, and they aren't so sure they want to build anymore until this financial crisis passes. The loans don't seem to bother them as much as it's the insurance.
In North Carolina, Stephanie Norris says she may have to balance out her portfolio by building further inland and pausing development of property in risky coastal areas. Coastal communities, however, need her apartments. Her tenants, she says, support the tourism economy.
Ultimately, it only drives our local workforce and people out of New Hanover County.
There's no silver bullet, but advocacy groups say there are some straightforward fixes, like having all the different federal agencies involved with affordable housing coordinate their insurance requirements, or creating certificate programs that make insurance companies more confident that a building is climate resilient. It's clear to low-income housing developers that something's got to give. The U.S. insurance system is struggling under the strain of climate disasters, with 24 of them costing more than $1 billion each so far this year. All of this is fueling an affordable housing crisis, especially in coastal areas. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Knoyer in Wilmington, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KAXE has a mission to build community throughout northern Minnesota. Our loyal audience supports the community organizations that support KAXE. Consider joining us in building community in northern Minnesota. Learn more. Email sponsor at kaxe.org. Thank you. Pine River Market Square, a local growers and crafters market, will wrap up their season with an indoor market tomorrow from 9 to 2 at the warehouse located on Norway Avenue in Pine River. Pequot Lakes Library hosts a book release celebration with local author Jan D. Payne tomorrow from 10 to 11:30. Her new book is Rabbit Moon, the first in a thriller series. Buck Lake Improvement Club hosts their monthly breakfast buffet Sunday, November 10th from 9 until noon at their community center, located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. The Bemidji Choral and Festival Orchestra presents a concert Sunday, November 10th at 3 p.m. at Thompson Recital Hall on the BSU campus. There will also be a pie auction and reception. Split Rock Lighthouse will hold its annual memorial for the 29 lives lost during the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald Sunday, November 10th. The names of the crew will be read at 4:15, with the lighthouse beacon lighting immediately afterwards. The ceremony will be live-streamed on the Minnesota Historical Society's YouTube channel. Volunteers are trained and ready to interview local veterans and service members for United Way of Northeastern Minnesota's Operation Service Stories Project. Interviews will be transcribed and archived. Learn more at UnitedWayNEMN.org/history. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In every state in the U.S., police officers are allowed to lie to people during interrogations. Now, a growing number of states are stopping that practice with juveniles in custody. Advocates in one state want a ban on deception that applies to everyone, not just kids. As NPR's Meg Anderson reports, they're being met with resistance.
Ted Bradford says the worst day of his life was when two detectives took him into a tiny room to question him about a rape.
The whole day it was like accusation after accusation. It was like, we know you did this. And I kept telling them over and over, I didn't do this.
Bradford says the officers in Yakima, Washington, told him they had DNA evidence that would prove he did it, and they weren't going to let him leave until he admitted it.
I'm thinking, in order to get out of this situation, I could just give them a statement. They'll test that evidence. It'll show that I didn't do it, and then this will all be done with.
After hours of questioning, Bradford confessed to the crime. But the evidence police had, a mask left at the scene, could not actually be DNA tested. This was the late 90s, and the technology wasn't there yet. He was 22, with two small children, when he went to prison.
For 9 years, it's like every day I woke up and knew that I shouldn't be there.
Advancements in DNA testing led to his exoneration in 2010. What happened to him is extreme, but the tactic police used, even 30 years later, is not.
Police are trained around the country in all 50 states to use deception during interrogation.
Laura Nyrider is a wrongful convictions attorney.
To lie both about the evidence against a suspect and to lie about the consequences of confessing in order to make it seem not so bad if you just say that you did these things.
Confessions carry a lot of weight in an investigation. And Nyrider says deception is a powerful tool to get them. Police can go into a room with a suspect
and emerge with one of the most believable pieces of evidence imaginable, a confession. It's a quick and relatively straightforward way to close a case.
The problem, she says, is that it is so effective that it also draws false confessions. Juveniles are especially swayed by deception. 10 states have passed laws in recent years banning police from lying to them during interrogations. But legal experts say other people are vulnerable too, like young adults and people with intellectual disabilities. In Washington state, lawmakers want to set a higher bar with a bill that would make a statement made by anyone, adult or child, inadmissible in court if it was obtained using deception. State Representative Strom Peterson has introduced the bill twice, but it hasn't gone anywhere.
Law enforcement is the biggest impediment to the bill. They believe that the system in which they work is effective.
The Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs declined NPR's request for an interview, but said in a statement that banning deception would take away a tactic that has yielded many more true confessions than false ones.
I'm embarrassed for them.
Jim Trainum is a retired homicide detective. He says these reforms make police more trustworthy. Because when they're allowed to lie, he says,
that carries on. And no wonder people don't trust us. Why should they trust us?
He says there's another way to question people that relies on open-ended questions and building rapport. That technique is used in much of Europe. That other path is why Peterson, the state lawmaker, plans to introduce the bill again. He says we're all better off when police use the best tools available to convict the right people. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
More than a month after Hurricane Helene, the VA Medical Center in Asheville is still sending teams to check on thousands of military veterans in western North Carolina. Jay Price of member station WUNC went out with one of those teams.
76-year-old Vietnam vet Cliff Stewart, everybody calls him Sarge, lives in the community of Swannanoa. His mobile home is just across the river from the devastated commercial district. Stewart has back and knee issues and uses a powered wheelchair. Like everybody here, the flood caught him by surprise.
And then the next thing I know, it's already above the windshield of the car.
It came in under his doors and welled up from the heating vents. VA nurse Matthew Bain had visited before.
The water was about, what, 2-3 feet in here?
It's 2 to 3 feet, yeah. It was just above the wheels on my wheelchair there.
Officials were still looking to reconnect his power. A small generator rattling out on the porch was mainly powering space heaters. A nonprofit company rebuilding his home has cut out much of the drywall and yanked out the insulation so the structure can dry out. A charity gave him a motorhome to live in temporarily. It was parked out front.
He can go there during the day, be out of the elements while they're in here gutting this place out.
Teams like this have been crisscrossing the mountains since Helene hit. After the storm, the VA put together a list of more than 2,600 veterans in the region at high risk because of serious health issues. Communications initially were almost impossible, and sometimes the VA couldn't reach them or their families. Patty Campbell, the chief nurse leading the VA outreach, said that left one alternative.
If we couldn't reach them by phone and we didn't hear from them on the email and they were the high-risk population, we had clinical staff in the vehicles going out.
It didn't always work. Sometimes the veteran was just unreachable. Other times,
some of the areas where we went to on the addresses, the home wasn't there.
The VA staff has had to care for veterans while dealing with their own storm-related struggles. Bain was without power for 15 days, but he said others had it worse.
We've got a couple of nurses we work with in primary care that have lost their homes completely that are just a total loss. Some of our staff have lost family members, some people have lost homes, some people lost nothing. Just like Western North Carolina, it's a gamut of everything.
Among the vets Bain's team had to reach was a hospice patient in Weaverville, cut off when a bridge to his house washed away.
Me and another nurse had to walk in water, food and supplies and backpacks about 2 miles in just to get him supplies. He had no medicines. They had no electricity. So, I mean, he was pretty much just at our whim of what we had we could give him.
Many of those getting visits are in wheelchairs, like 50-year-old Donald Harris. Harris has multiple sclerosis and lives with his brother high up a mountain. A huge mudslide ripped right past their house, miraculously missing it, but destroying their steep quarter-mile dirt driveway. He was evacuated by a military helicopter. The terrain was too steep for it to land, so he was lifted out of his yard in a metal basket. He only recently returned home to a shattered community where 13 of his neighbors died in the storm. Harris was in the shower when the team arrived, so they had to wait before he rolled out onto the porch.
Hey, Mr. Harris.
How's it going?
Good, brother. We didn't want to mess up your bath.
The VA team checked his medicine, the condition of his legs, talked with him about how the VA could make his bathroom more accessible, then said goodbye. For now.
I'm sure I'll see you again. What's this, four or five times? I'll be back again, I'm sure.
As many times as it takes, he said. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Swannanoa, North Carolina.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Information about the wonders of the universe is at templeton.org. From Insperity, providing HR services and technology, from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at insperity.com/HR matters. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations order food online from a nationwide network of restaurants, with tools designed to help save time and manage food spend, all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. The Central Lakes College Music Department presents its fall concert, Rhythm is Going to Get You, Tuesday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Chalberg Theater on the Brainerd campus. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies with lows 24 to 34 degrees. Tomorrow, slight chance of rain, increasing clouds, highs 48 to 51. South wind, 5 to 20 miles per hour. And Sunday, chance of rain before noon, mostly cloudy, highs 46 to 49.